Okay, so this week is class 9, and we're going to be looking at the mitzvah of hallowing the Sabbath with words, mitzvah number 31, and mitzvah number 32, not to work on the Sabbath, and if we get to it, 36 and 37. Okay, so mitzvah 31, to hallow the Sabbath in words. So it's interesting, this mitzvah of Kiddush Shabbat Bedvarim is actually expressed through Kiddush, making Kiddush. So, and this is part of the Ten Commandments. This is in, remember, in Parshat Yitro, Yisro, where the Ten Commandments are listed. So the commandment is, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So the question is always, how do you do it? Right? So how do you remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy? So the answer is Kiddush and Havdalah. And it's interesting that Kiddush and Havdalah are one mitzvah, not two separate mitzvahs. Hmm. So those two mitzvahs are this. Those two expressions of hallowing the Sabbath in words are tied to this one sentence. It's one mitzvah. So Kiddush and Havdalah. So to open Shabbos and close Shabbos with words over a cup of wine. So it discusses the wine. Why do we make Kiddush over wine? And this is tied into our mitzvah number 16 also, which was the not breaking the bone for the Paschal offering, where he discusses that we're behaviorists, that we're affected according to our behavior. Excuse me. So, let's see. So remember it over wine, and it talks about how much wine or how do you do it. It has to be a certain amount of wine. Okay, so the third paragraph is, at the root of this mitzvah lies the purpose that we should be stirred as a result of this deed to remember the greatness of the day and affirm in our heart our enduring faith in the creation of the world out of non-existence. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, we were commanded to perform this deed with wine. For a man's nature is greatly stirred by it, as it sustains and gives joy. And I have already told you in mitzvah number 16 that to the degree that a man is moved and inspired by his deed, so he is always influenced. So I think this is very interesting, that I'm just reflecting on how Judaism does use brain chemistry. You know, because we are using wine specifically. So we can fulfill this mitzvah with grape juice. But the mitzvah is to use wine, and it is because, so two things, it sustains and gives joy. So the gives joy is brain chemistry. It's misameach, that's what it says. Misaed and misameach. So misaed sustains, su'uda, the word su'uda is a meal, but it is sustenance, right? So it uses the language misaed, bless you. It sustains and gives joy. So I'm not exactly sure how wine sustains. It's not like food, it's not like bread. That it sustains you. Sometimes for a snack, I'll drink an Adwala juice, you know, but wine is never a snack drink. Right. You know, so how does it sustain? I'm not sure about that. But certainly misameach. So, and one isn't, it's not talking about drunkenness here, it's just talking about the slight high that one gets from a few sips, it's misameach. Mm-hmm. So that we do use brain chemistry, and we use it even more Pesach time, because there is a drunkenness that's incurred Pesach time with 4 cups of wine. Now, really, it's 2 cups kind of in a row, and then a whole meal, and then 2 cups later on. But part of drinking the wine Pesach time is to bring us out of a state of total consciousness, of total awareness, that we should be slightly beyond intellect for the Seder. And then Purim, too, we also use wine to take us even further out into a state of not supposed to be sloppy drunk on Purim, but we are supposed to be tipsy enough that we don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. Some people say that if you just drink enough that makes you sleepy and you fall asleep, then you won't know the difference too. But there certainly is a tradition in the yeshiva world, incorrect now to get very drunk, but a tradition in the yeshiva world to get pleasantly drunk. The boys take it to extreme now, and it's done incorrectly. It's done dangerously. So every year they write stuff, you know, about the boys shouldn't be given drinks. Pardon?
They get into very big trouble. Right.
Who gets into very big trouble?
Yeshiva.
the Shiva could get into very big trouble. Yeah. The boys can get into very big trouble. The boys go from house to house raising tzedakah money too, and people think it's funny to give them a shot. We've been told not to because they go from house to house collecting and they have a shot at each house, and pretty soon it adds up to what the boys enjoy, but you have, you know, ninth graders who aren't heavy enough passing out. So it's not a good idea. Anyway, so I was just reflecting on this concept of how we do use brain chemistry. And there are religions around the world that use chemically altering substances for religious use, and we do too here. It's interesting just to see. We don't have other things that we do, and it's not to a huge extent. We're not supposed to be psychedelic or anything. We don't have any mushrooms in our, and mushrooms certainly existed, and other things existed, you know, that could have been discussed or used. They're not. Wine's the only thing. And yet it is there. And it's about making an impression. So the purpose of using words and using wine, both, to make an impression on the soul. So I think it's just interesting to think about those two pathways. There's an intellectual pathway and a non-intellectual pathway to affect our soul. So, and the use of words is a very strong thing in Judaism as well, because God created the world through words. And he chose that pathway specifically so that words would have a creative and the opposite force. I think as we talked about last time, when we talked about not making a false promise or making incorrect promises. So the power of words. So here again, we see the power of words. Excuse me. And how important they are to use to create sanctity, and they can be used for other things too. But here we have this pathway of, how do we fulfill this mitzvah? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy? We use words and wine. So now it's interesting that for Kiddush, we are permitted, if we like bread better than wine, we're permitted to make Kiddush over bread. Hmm. But not for Havdalah. For Havdalah, we have to make Havdalah over wine, not bread. So it could be, there's all kinds of halachas. Can you use beer? Can you use other drinks? What's the story with that? And that's part of the what of the mitzvah. And where else is it found? So that is discussed.
You would still say Pari HaGafe?
No. You make the correct bracha. Say Hamotzi instead of Pari HaGafe. Right. Yeah, for sure. No, Kiddush is the other part, that whole paragraph. And then the Bori Pari HaGafen is the blessing on the wine. That's not actually Kiddush. The Kiddush is the whole process of sanctifying the day through this blessing over the thing. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't say Bori Pari HaGafen on bread. You'd say Hamotzi Lecha Min Haaretz. So you're permitted to do that for the first. And now, that being said, I just want to be careful to say, I'm not sure that we learn practical halacha from this book. So I'm not sure if that's the halacha today. If you're just, you can do it that way. Let's say you don't have wine for whatever reason. So you could say Kiddush on bread. You drove up to the mountains. It was too snowy to get down. You didn't bring wine with you, but you have bagels. You can make Kiddush on bagels. So, and that's a proper Kiddush. But I don't know if we do that l'chatchila, you know, in the first place, if we're planning Shabbos. I don't know if we plan it that way. I'm just not sure. So I don't want to say that. But for Havdalah, we do not. And the reason is for both. So it's to make an impression. So to use something that makes an impression. So if one likes bread better than wine, to make the impression on their soul, they can use what they like best. But for all of us, after Shabbos, we've had three big meals, or two big and a medium meal. Nobody's really hungry Havdalah time. So even if you like bread better, you'd rather have a drink than something to eat for Havdalah, because we're all fed at that time. So people are hungry at the beginning of Shabbos, not at the end of Shabbos. So Havdalah has to be made on a drink, not a food. Hmm. So it's about the impression that it makes on the soul. You know, so you can choose your thing. If you see this theme here, the impression on the soul, that's what has to happen through this. So you can choose the food that makes the stronger impression, wine that makes you happy, or bread, if that makes you happy. And actually, this ties in a little bit to vegetarianism. I remember in my early days of being Jewish, I was vegetarian. Not really because I chose it, just because I kind of fell into it, and then I sort of chose it after that. But I realize in hindsight now that I chose it because it was, you had to be on a meal plan, either the meat meal plan or the vegetarian meal plan. And meat every day was too much for me. I didn't come from a house that ate meat every day, so my parents were more health foodie. So I just chose the vegetarian plan. But then people started asking me about why I'm a vegetarian, so I just kind of made up reasons about it. I wasn't really. But then I decided to be because I realized now in hindsight that was a way for me to be different once I was in Israel. Because in high school, I was different by being Jewish. In Israel, everybody was Jewish, so how's that going to be different there? So vegetarian worked out nicely for the first few years. So there's lots of, every time I went to somebody's house for Shabbos, the whole conversation was why I was a vegetarian. I was constantly making up reasons. But so I learned more about vegetarianism. So one of the big arguments I would get is, I say, Ein simcha ela b'basar v'yayin. There is no joy except through meat and wine. So on Shabbos, you're supposed to have meat and wine. And holidays, for sure. Shabbos is one thing, but holidays, for sure, because holidays, you have an obligation to be happy. Shabbos, you don't have an obligation to be happy, but there is a concept of delight in Shabbos. So you should eat foods that delight you. But on Yom Tov, you have to be happy. And so they say there's no happiness through meat and wine. So is there room for a vegetarian to have happiness, more happiness in other foods than in meat and wine? So it seems that there is, if they're a vegetarian, for taste reasons. They like tofu better than meat, they should have tofu, right? There's not really halachic room if they're vegetarians for moral reasons. If I don't eat animals because I feel it's wrong, then you should eat it on Shabbos and Yom Tov. You could not eat it the rest of the time, but you're not permitted to take on an extra stringency. The Torah does not forbid eating meat. And so we're not supposed to forbid ourselves from eating it. You could say, I don't like it, it's not my taste, and that's fine. You don't have to eat it. Yeah, I don't digest it well, whatever it is, those are fine. But to say, I don't eat my friends, you know, so that's a problem halachically, to add on an additional stringency that the Torah doesn't include. So Rav Kook, for instance, was a vegetarian, but he had a spoonful of chicken broth every Shabbos. Just to show that he wasn't taking on the halacha of not eating meat, that he didn't believe that it was a halacha, it just was his preference not to eat it. So here we do see that there is room for preference. So you can have what you prefer, and you're supposed to be brought to simcha. So we have to, again, this shows then how Judaism requires self-knowledge. What makes you happy? And how will you engage that? So we do need to know ourselves and what we prefer. So here it's a very light example. Most people know if they prefer bread or wine, you know, what makes them happier. But in general, Judaism does require a level of self-knowledge to properly keep the halachas. And so here's an example where knowing what makes you happy is what is the best way to fulfill this mitzvah. Again, I'm not saying that's the practical halacha for today, but as a concept. Okay, so let's see. And this halacha, even though it is a time-bound positive commandment to make kiddush, applies, the last paragraph, it applies in every place and every time for both man and woman, even though it's one of the precepts whose observance is dependent upon time. For so our sages of blessed memory taught us that women are obligated to observe kiddush and havdalah. He who transgresses it and does not hallow the Sabbath with words disobeys a positive precept. And if someone sanctifies it with words but without wine or bread, since it is done, he has fulfilled the Torah's requirements, meaning b'di'evid. If he did it, but he didn't use wine or bread, so he did do the bare minimum mitzvah. He didn't transgress by not doing the mitzvah. But the mitzvah is best done with wine or bread. Right, and this is a positive commandment that affects women as well. So women are released from many time-bound commandments, but not this one. So, for that reason, a woman can make kiddush for a man. For other reasons, women don't make kiddush for men. But they technically can, because their mitzvah is the same as for that of a man.
Oh, okay.
So, we're not allowed to, we can have each other in mind for a mitzvah. And so we can do a mitzvah and take care of somebody else's obligation, which is what we usually do for kiddush. One person makes kiddush for everybody at the table. Everybody has their own mitzvah of kiddush. But one person does it and has everybody in mind, and then everybody It's called yotze. Everybody goes out of their obligation. Everybody is yotze through that. And the person who's doing it is motzi everybody. It is actually the same root as hamotzi lechem min haaretz, who brings forth bread from the ground. So to bring forth that, if you go out of your obligation, somebody could bring out of you that obligation in a way, right? Can take you out of it. So somebody who's motzi. So the one who makes kiddush is motzi everybody else, and then everybody else is yotze by him. So can a woman motzi a man in kiddush? Yes, she can. Is that our custom? It is not, because it's interesting, and I think it's probably a little bit different today, but depending on the circles that you travel in. But in general, it's considered that a man would be embarrassed if a woman does it, because it would mean he can't. So certainly if a man is sick, or he has laryngitis or whatever, so the wife can make kiddush for the whole family, because he can't. But the question would be then, in a regular situation, if the man's not making kiddush, why isn't he? Does he not read Hebrew? Does he not, know the word? Is he not present psychologically that he can do it? Like, why do you need a woman to do it? So for that reason, women don't, because it would embarrass a man. I think depending on the circles that somebody's traveling in, there are certain communities where it wouldn't embarrass a man anymore. So a woman could, because the obligation is exactly the same. For Havdalah, even though a woman has to make it, in general, a woman does not motzi a man for Havdalah. In general, actually, women should try to find a man to make Havdalah for her. And I think that has to do with the blessing over the fire. And I'm not 100% clear on this. So while a woman definitely has the obligation to make Havdalah, it's really better she not say it on her own. And there's the whole tradition of women not drinking the Havdalah wine also.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Why?
So I'm going to say something weird. I'll let you say it.
Oh, no.
You don't know? So it's something weird, and who knows if it's true? I have no clue at all whatsoever. The tradition is, if you ask any 5-year-old girl why she doesn't drink it, it's because she doesn't want to grow a beard. That girls grow facial hair if they drink from it. What does that mean? Like, where did that come from? Is that based in anything? I don't know what it means.
It sounds like folktale.
At all. It does sound like folktale, and yet it's universally known. So what does it mean? It's more known than spitting, for an ayin hara, which is just, whatever that is. So I think it is folktale, and yet it's so universal that women really don't drink from it. Hmm. So
when I make Havdalah, I probably shouldn't drink the wine?
No, you have to.
Juice.
You have to. You made a bracha. So you have to. You should try to hear it from a man.
Well,
should have Bob come over and make it for you.
So late.
It's not so late right now. It's so late in the summertime. But in general, it's best. Yeah, a woman should have a man make it for her.
I'm hearing you over the phone.
I don't know. That's a good question.
People do. Women do. Them.
Yeah, that's a good question. So hearing it over the phone then. Yeah, so I'd ask Ashila about it, because it really is a thing that women shouldn't be making it. I think some of it has to do Kabbalistically with the sin of Eve and the flame. And when we look at our fingernails, and some women don't look at their fingernails even. I think most do, but some don't, because looking at our fingernails is reminding us of the light, L-I-G-H-T, bodies that we were before we became flesh bodies. Because we see that light, we see that thin, but that's the thin, translucent part of our body today that reminds us of what our bodies were like before they were this heavy. And the reason they became this heavy is because of the sin of Chava. So maybe women don't participate in that, either looking at it or saying it, because of that initial sin. So there's stuff in there, and I don't know all of it, but I do know that women don't make it if they can avoid it at all, and they actually exert themselves to not make it. So either having a man come over and make it for them, and a man can make it more than once, and make all the brachas again.
And he can make it the next day.
Yes, but you can't eat till you hear it.
Oh, you can't eat till you hear it?
Mm-mm. Mm. You can make it till Tuesday. Mm. But you can't eat until you have Della. Mm. So, right.
It might be good for me.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So that's...
I knew it was not preferable. I knew that.
It's strongly not preferable. It's not usser. A woman can make
it. Right.
It's strongly not preferable.
It's just for myself. It's not...
Right. No, it's not about that. It's strongly not preferable that you make it for yourself. Right. So if you have to, you have to. There's nobody around. There's nobody around. But I think it probably does pay to ask about a telephone havdalah. You know, look at how will that work? Because it is really a thing that women don't make havdalah. But they can.
Yeah, Rabbi Levitansky would do it, I know, when he does it for his family just down the street.
Right. So that kind of thing. You know, there's definitely people.
I'm in my robe, my feet are up.
So ask about the phone. And if not, say you'll walk down the street. It's a mitzvah. You know, and your feet will carry you longer because you did more mitzvahs with them.
I'm already eating bread for Shemesh.
Good job.
Yeah, right.
Good job. Okay, so that is sanctifying a Sabbath through words. So that's how we fulfill the mitzvah, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And now we have a separate mitzvah, number 32, not to do any work on the Sabbath. So that comes from the verse, you shall not do any work at all, you or your son or your daughter, your maidservant, your manservant, or your cattle. Opposite, your manservant, maidservant, or your cattle. Right, so that's actually a double thing here. You can't do any work. That's clear. And we actually have that from a different verse as well. But you also can't cause or even permit the work of any people in these categories. So not your kids. So the question is, kids, from what age do you prevent a child from doing something? You know, little kids, like toddlers, we don't stop them from banging on their play xylophone or let's say they're in a walker. Today all the walkers have electric things, you know, and they press the buttons and it makes noise and lights go off and all that stuff. We don't prevent an 18-month-old from doing that. That's not considered. But from the age of about 3, we do. So we prevent them from doing that, and we do train them at that point. And we would, once they understand what they're doing. So, I'm just thinking about my grandson. So and it depends on the child. From the age that they can turn light switches on and off, you can allow them to do that. Let's say you left your hall light on, right? Your hall light on, and you want it off, and they just like to flip the switch. You can hold them near the switch and let them flip it. But if they know it turns the light on or off, then you can't anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's one thing to be able to do the action, and there's the other thing of the connection between the action and the light. Once they make that connection, whatever age that is for them, you can't let them do it anymore. So not that you have to pull them away, but you can't ask them. You can't like hold them next to it anymore.
Right.
You can't hold them next to it anymore. So, but from about age 3, you have to pull them away from it and teach them that it's Shabbos and you can't do this on Shabbos. Right. Right. So as I said, you shall not do any work at all, you or your son or your daughter. So you're both children of both genders. You have to prevent them from it. Your manservant, your maidservant, or your cattle, you can't facilitate or allow them to do any kind of work on Shabbos. So, there's different levels here. There can be no doubt that even though the scripture expressed the ban on work for us, our children, servants, and domestic animals, all in one negative precept, the matter is not the same for all. For if someone does work with his own body, he incurs death by sentence of the Beit Din, if he has done it deliberately. For the work of others, however, even though he's adjured about them to prevent them by a negative precept over them, he incurs not even the punishment of whiplashes, for lashes are never given for the actions of others. So while it's completely forbidden to permit your maidservant, and I don't know if that counts, I mean, a housekeeper, is that it's a different thing.
I didn't know if you wanted to shut that off because I was going to bring that up again.
No, right, so you're not allowed to let your housekeepers do things. Absolutely not.
Even if they're not Jewish?
Even if they're not Jewish. They're only allowed to do what you can do. And then they can choose how to do it. So, for instance, you are permitted to wash dishes on Shabbos. You have to use cold water and one of those plastic thingies that you can't wring out, a scrubby thing. Mm-hmm. Can't use a sponge, you can't use hot water. You can use soap, you can wash dishes. She can wash dishes, she can use a sponge and hot water if she wants to. She's permitted to do it how she wants. You are permitted to sweep. You can ask her to sweep. You're not permitted to use a vacuum cleaner. She can't use a vacuum cleaner. So there is question in the realm of dishwashers. Can she, for her convenience, use a dishwasher? You're permitted to wash dishes. Can she wash the dishes how she wants to wash them? That's still an area where the general answer today is no, she can't. But there is question in that era. in the area. And the question really is around not the use of the electricity, because perhaps you could set your dishwasher on a timer. The problem really is, and we do use timers now for other electrical appliances, but there's a problem with making noise on Shabbos. Mm. Not that, like, you could pound on a table and sing or stamp your feet, you can make that kind of noise, but having an appliance that makes noise so that it's clear the appliance is being used is a problem. I think this is one reason why it's changed. The halacha is still in flux. Dishwashers are so quiet today. Mm-hmm. So I think if you see somebody who has set their dishwasher on a timer and the lights don't go on and everything when they close the door, whatever it is, and their dishwasher's quiet, you shouldn't think they're breaking Shabbos. But you probably also shouldn't do it yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's not yet accepted like Shabbos clocks are accepted, like those timers are accepted. Everybody knows if a light turns on and off in a Shomer Shabbos house, they didn't do it. Right? So it's very clear that that's accepted across the board today, whereas initially it was not. So today I think dishwashers are in that place where it's not really accepted yet, and yet I think there's a way to do it that it's not actually usher. But it's not accepted that we do it yet today. So, but for instance, laundry, can a housekeeper that you have do laundry at her convenience? And if it's her convenience to do it on Shabbos, can she do it on Shabbos? No, she can't. She has to come a different day to do the laundry. Could she fold it? She probably could. Whereas you shouldn't really. It's not Shabbistic to be folding laundry. So she probably could fold it. But she cannot turn on your dryer or your washing machine or vacuum. Let's say you break a glass and there's glass all over the place. Can she clean it up and tear paper towels to get down on her hands and knees and, you know, carefully sweep the glass with your towel? Yeah, she can. She can tear, you know, so because you can clean that up, she can do it how she wants to do it.
Well, but that's also considered a hazard, isn't there? Some
right, so it can be cleaned up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Glass would be a hazard.
Yeah. Right, but does that mean she can vacuum it? No, but she can mm-hmm. clean it up carefully, and you can ask her to clean it up. You can do that anyway. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to clean it up. Possibly, let's say in terms of hazard, let's say she was leaving and she had to go and you have to clean it up. You probably in that case could ask her to turn on the light so you could see it clearly because it's a hazard. I'm not paskening, well, but I'm saying there's room for those kinds of things like that.
You can ask a non-Jew to turn on the light for you.
Not just some, you can't.
Well, you have to do it in a sort of company.
Not even so much. Not so much. They have to benefit from the light. You can't say, gosh, it's dark in here.
I thought you could.
You can't. You can't. This is the way you have to do it. You have to say, can you please get me my slippers? And the room is dark, and they need the light to see your slippers. So they turn it on so that they can see your slippers, and then you say, you can leave the light on. But the light has to be for their benefit, not for yours. So if you're reading, let's say you have a mother who's not Shomer Shabbos. You're reading, and she doesn't like you reading in the dusk, right, as the light starts to fade. So she turns on the lamp for you. You can't sit there.
You can't take benefit from that.
You can't take benefit. So that's your Jewish mother. Let's say it's your non-Jewish mother. You can't sit there. Now, let's say your non-Jewish mother actually cares about you in your eyes. It's her benefit that her daughter should have the benefit. It's a tricky thing. I had to ask this Shiloh. Like, it's not, I'm happy to read in the dark. I don't mind. It bothers her that I'm reading in the dark. It's for her benefit that she's turning on the light for me. It's not for my benefit because I don't care. Then I'm permitted to use it. But that's only for me. Sorry.
Right. Right.
So, but it has to be. So my mother knows all the rules. She'll say, gosh, I want a cup of tea right now. And I only like tea made from very full urns. So I'm going to fill up the whole thing because I only like tea from the top cup. And anybody else who wants tea can help themselves to the leftover water. So that's really, I think, actually in the questionable realm, because she really is making it for us and not for her. But she knows that it has to be for her benefit.
She is making it for herself.
If she's making it for herself, then she is permitted to make, you know, to turn on the water, and you could use the leftover. I think it's probably a question if she's filling up the whole thing, knowing that it's for the rest of the family. There's no way she's going to drink that much. But let's say she just, you know, how you fill up those, like, instant heat kettles, and you're not measuring how much you want. Right? You just fill it up, and then you put it on and turn it on. So the leftover cup, probably somebody else, mm-hmm. definitely, somebody else is permitted to use that. Mm-hmm. So, but right, so the you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbos. That's not their thing. But that being said, you can ask them to do something for you when there's a hazard, or when it's for the congregation, for a congregation, so not in your home, or it's for safety, or I think like even let's say it's very cold out, you could ask somebody to come in and turn on your heat for you. If it's very hot, can you ask somebody to come in and turn on your air conditioning? Not in your house, but in shul, it's very hot. You are allowed to ask a non-Jew to turn on the air conditioning for the shul. So I'm not sure where that line goes. You know, you're hosting Sheva Brachas Shabbos afternoon. You know, so are you now big enough with your 20 guests that you can ask a non-Jew to turn on the air conditioning? I don't know. That's where all the lines get fine. Right. You know, I don't know all the answers to that.
Right. Well, I know at a Sheva Brachas there were unopened bottles on the table. And I personally avoid trying to do it. I try to prepare before Shabbos to have everything open, and I'm not, you know.
But some people open bottles.
Yes, some do. So at that point, someone said, "Do you open bottles?"
Right.
And I said, "Yes, I do." What they told me I needed to do was I must pour some of that in a cup for me and take benefit from
it.
Oh,
interesting.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Uh-huh. Because some people open bottles and some people don't. So, right.
Uh-huh. Alerted me to that. I said I didn't know that because I had opened bottles for other people and things.
I didn't know that.
So he said,
interesting.
Just pour a little
You're
bit
a wild
in your
girl,
cup.
You know? They're opening those bottles.
Right.
Right.
Right. So some people do this.
You have to watch it because sometimes there's printing.
And then you can't open it.
Then you can't form another word by breaking.
Or break a word.
Right.
Or break a word.
I mean, it's really, it's all mindfulness.
Total mindfulness. All the time.
That's really the essence, mm-hmm. and that's even as a person, you know, so outside it all, I can just see.
It is. It is all mindfulness, and
it's good.
It makes total sense. A lot of people say it's so picayune, but the truth is, everybody has their how you do something, mm-hmm. And being mindful in it. So I was just reading RafiNews.org, whatever Rafi the kid singer. So he's blogging about child honoring. So he has a whole site about honoring children and repairing the world through honoring children. You would love it. You should look it up.
I love Rob. I haven't heard of him in so long.
I met him on the boat on the way to Victoria. It was my big celebrity moment. So anyway, he has this whole thing, child honoring, RafiNews.com. And so he's blogging about that. But he has a whole manifesto, like we hold these celebrations to be self-evident or something like that, that all children are created with dignity and purpose and value and that we should be taking care of that as adults. And then he has his like 9 points about how we repair the world through honoring children. But anybody who cares about anything has to have what they do because of it. Right? So if you honor children in his world, then you have to recycle because how do you bequeath a toxic planet to children? You know, so there does have to be how you do it. If you're actually honoring, does it mean you just in your heart do it? No, it means you have to behave in certain ways. You have to buy sustainable foods and you have to, you know, and you have to create school systems that take care of people and you have to work with the justice system that they're not incarcerating 5-year-olds for pinching somebody else's tush in kindergarten or whatever it is. Like you have to work with all that stuff. So there has to be ways that you do it. So not in Judaism too. This is just to show you the principle that if you care about something, if something is a principle, there are ways to behave around that principle. So that's what halacha really is how do you behave around that principle? What does it mean, don't do work on Shabbos? Does it mean don't go into the office? If you're a psychologist, does it mean don't solve people's problems? You know, what does it mean? So there has to be a what does it mean.
And on that issue of your servant, my husband, who's a lawyer, had a very observant client, and somehow they got across the notion that they didn't want them working on their case
on Shabbos.
On Shabbos.
Right, right.
You know, and it was just, they brought that up proactively,
right.
Which I thought was so nice. You know,
right.
That's just,
nice.
That's thinking.
Right. Right.
Thinking ahead and thinking
right.
of where your money goes. And that literally if you got that bill and the bill was working on a Saturday, that would really
right.
not be congruent. With
right, it wouldn't be congruent, especially because he's a Jewish right. lawyer. So you don't want somebody putting in work on Shabbos
right.
right for you.
Right.
Right. So that's what this is. Don't cause. So that's what I'm not sure. Manservant, maidservant, what does that mean? Does that include your lawyer? It might at this point, because that is somebody you're hiring to do work. But are they in your house or not? So, and that's Jew and non-Jew. So there's all kinds of different questions exactly what that means. But we don't cause people to work on our behalf on Shabbos. That's the basic principle. So that being said, we are permitted to sit in a room with electricity on that we left on before, even though somebody's running the plant. But they're not running the plant just for us. So it's, and I don't know how it works exactly
it's
in
like
Israel.
Using
it's a little different.
Hot water in a hotel.
Right. You can use hot water in a hotel. Yeah. You can't use it in your own home.
Right.
Because the hot water tank.
Complex.
Right. The hot water in the tank is big enough.
Everybody else.
That you're. It's not just
I'm
that,
not
but
causing it to click on.
What you're using, right, is not. Is not diminishing the supply enough that you're triggering it to turn on.
Right.
Right. So then you are permitted in a hotel, but not in a private home. Okay. And then it has a long thing about animals and working with animals and what does it mean if you're walking behind them, if you're walking next to them, are you causing them, or are you just witnessing them? So since I don't fully, you know, understand all the ramifications of that, I'm not going to go into that, but that is here in this mitzvah. So let's just look on this almost
actually,
last page.
Walking your dog, there are certain rules and regulations in connection to if your dog needs to be walked and taken out.
Right, but that's not working them ever.
No, that's not working.
Not working them.
That's true.
That's only about
right.
leashes,
right.
which you are permitted to use
right.
even outside the
roof. Yeah, if it doesn't hang out from below here like a rein,
mm-hmm.
I decided that's what it had to do with. Like if you had a horse and buggy, mm-hmm. you would have reins, and those reins would be hanging down here. I'm thinking there's a connection there where you're working your horse, which is carrying.
No, it's not about working them, though. It's not. It's about carrying the leash. Are you carrying it, or is the dog carrying it?
Right. Well, and but not having it hang out.
I don't know.
Below,
I don't know the halachas
you know,
of
I don't either,
leashes outside the eruv, but I know that there are halachas of leashes outside
would
the eruv.
Hang out. You've got reins here, so you would be actually working your horse, carrying you someplace.
Right, but I'm saying I don't think it's connected. I don't think that's connected, because that's about working, and this is about carrying two separate things on Shabbos.
Okay.
The connection of Shabbos, but not the not the shape of the thing that's hanging from your wrist. I don't think. Okay, so let's see. This doesn't help for you, but like, let's see, page 179 helps for you. About five paragraphs from the end. At the root of this precept lies the purpose that we should remain away from our normal occupations in honor of the day, in order to affirm in our souls our belief in the creation of the world out of non-existence, which is a cord that pulls along with it all the basic tenets of the religion. And so we ought to remember on one day every single week that the world was created in six separate days, and on the seventh, nothing was created. And each and every day, something separate, distinct was created, demonstrating the simple, pure, divine will, in contradiction to the theory of the philosophizers who are abhorrent to us with their hypothesis, thinking that along with his existence, everything existed. So that's Aristotelian philosophy, that there was that the universe was is static and constant and always existed. So clearly Shabbat is about God made the world something out of nothing. It didn't exist and then it came into existence.
Well, and I think that key word for people who are trying to understand why can't you braid something? Why can't you change something? The word created versus work.
Right, it's very important to understand. So it does not have to do with work, right.
Right, it's really not work. It's creating something that wasn't there before.
Or influencing the planet in any way.
Okay.
It's exerting any creative energy.
Okay.
Yeah, it's exerting any creative energy. Because you're not creating electricity that wasn't there before. And even a circuit that you open and close.
Right.
You know, so we don't close it. It was there before, closed, and we opened it and closed it. But why don't we turn the switches on and off? Which is actually also questionable in halacha. But we don't. It's not about creating something that wasn't there before. You can certainly create a baby on Shabbos. It wasn't there before.
Right. Okay. So explain that to me a little bit better then.
We don't exert creative influence on the world. So those 39, and so specifically, how do we not do it? We specifically refrain from the 39 categories of work that it took to build the Mishkan. So the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the desert, was If you see that as a building that utilized mankind's creative capacity to create a place in which Hashem would dwell among us. And I was just thinking, I don't know why I have these moments, but I was just thinking today as I walked into the bathroom and brushed my teeth and read the label on a box in the bathroom, I thought to myself, isn't that cool that I can read those letters? You know, like here's a bunch of letters just in a row. And I have the brain capacity to be able to read them. And as human beings on the planet, we've created letters and we put them in rows and then we can communicate stuff with each other that way. It's so cool. And I have the brain capacity to absorb that just by looking at that box. I know it. It's so cool that I have that. So human beings are different than every other animal on the planet. We have vastly different capacity. And so the building of the Mishkan, does God need a building to live in? For sure not. Not at all whatsoever. Do human beings need to use their creative capacity to the fullness of their humanity to say, God, I invite you into my world? Yes. That's what building the Mishkan is. Using all of our human capacities. That's why there's so much law about how do you build it? How do you shear the sheep? How do you cart it? How do you dye it? How do you spin it? How do you weave it? What color should it be? Exactly what color should it be? Where do you hang this? How do you build that table? To what length and dimension? It's all about using our capacity. A beaver can build a dam, but he's not measuring the sticks that he's using. You know, he's not taking out a ruler and doing the measure twice, cut once thing. You know, he's just building it. So other creatures can do things that we can do, but nothing like us. So building the Mishkan is using all of our creative capacity to create a structure to invite God into our lives. And Shabbos is when we say, I am not using that creative capacity. I am a human being. I have tremendous capacity to affect the planet. But I am choosing right now to step back and say, God is the main creator. I'm just an ancillary creator. All my power is only because God gives it to me. And so therefore I shepherd the power that God gave to me. It's like giving 10% of your money to tzedakah. It's not my money. I shepherd the money. It's my job to create justice by spending in different ways. Right? So it's my job to use my creative capacity 6 days a week and not on the seventh. Which doesn't mean that we can't think creatively. We are permitted to think creatively. But it does mean we can't act creatively. So, I mean, I don't think it would be possible to ask us to not think creatively. Our minds
why
generate thoughts.
Why is braiding, other than part of the 39 malach, I know, what...
Doesn't no, matter. It's part of the 39.
Okay.
No,
okay.
You can't just pull that
okay.
one. It's not
right.
saying why is it wrong. It's arranging things in a way that nature doesn't arrange it. There's nothing braided in nature.
Okay.
Right? So that braiding is a clear symbol of human intervention, which is one reason why we braid challah. And one reason why we braid challah in six. It's clearly human beings that take the six strands, 6 days of the week, and braid them together. And together it creates the one Shabbos. So the six braided challah on your Shabbos table says, 6 days of the week are manifest in this one Shabbos. This is my human effort that was done before Shabbos to braid this, to say on Shabbos I refrain from this. So there's gobs of stuff everywhere.
Right.
I know, Judaism is so rich. Everywhere, everywhere.
39 malachas, all of those pertain to things that were done in...
Right. In the Mishkan.
The Mishkan.
That's
right.
correct. Right. That's how we make the definition. It's 39 major categories with tons of small print.
Mm-hmm.
Braiding is building, actually. Mm-hmm. So braiding is not one of the 39. It's derived from building.
My granddaughter could not understand
right.
why I couldn't braid her hair.
No. Right.
What is braiding? What is
right. that? It's building.
Of course, my son, mother, really?
Right.
You know?
For sure. For
I
sure.
It's a Jewish thing. Just
right. right. And sometimes you have to just say that. I mean, and it is confusing.
That fact pattern happened is so interesting. I mean, it's like she may be 60 years old and remember that
right.
day.
Right.
It's just so...
Right.
Again,
right.
that's very rich.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's just
right.
sweet in a way.
Yeah.
Right, so let's look at what it says here, this next paragraph. By resting on the seventh day, we will recall the creation of the world out of non-existence. For when people will all rest from work on one day of the week, and whoever wonders at it will ask, what is the reason for this rest? Then the answer will be, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and on the seventh day he rested. Everyone will be strengthened and confirmed in the true faith by this. So this is an interesting thing. This is so now this is not about us. We know that we rest because we are affirming the fact that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But there's a concept of the communal rest being noticed. Mm-hmm. So when we all rest, then the communal rest will be noticed. So in your own home, when somebody says, Bubby, why can't you braid, right? It's a little bit different than communal rest, but somebody's noticing. You're doing something different on this day. So what you say is, I'm doing something different on this day to affirm the fact that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. Hi. So, almost done. Sorry, a little over time here.
No, I like to listen.
So that the answer should be, so this is part of the Or Lagoyim concept. Right? We're supposed to be a light unto the nations. And how are we a light? A light shines. We've said many times before, a light doesn't speak, a light is seen. And so through our behavior, we behave in this way of refraining from work, then people will look at us and say, why are you doing these weird things? Right? It's definitely strange. The way that we refrain from work is different than the way other people rest. Right? So we have specific types of rest which are strange. So it's also about creating an image of what you're doing is different. I need to ask a question about this. Why are you doing this? And then your answer is, I'm doing this to proclaim the fact that God made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And then that helps create the situation in which everyone will be strengthened and confirmed in the true faith by this. I think that'll take a while to get to. But that's the idea, is that there should be that concept. And then the last paragraph here, it remains in force in every place and every time for both man and woman. One who transgresses it intentionally is stoned to death, providing that there are witnesses and a warning, which there hardly ever are. You should always have this rule with you. So here's the rule. There can be no death penalty or whiplashes except where there were witnesses and a warning. The warning always serves to differentiate between the intentional and unintentional sinner. Keep this principle in mind, everywhere in mind, and do not ask of me to repeat it. And if someone did conscious work on the Shabbos, on the Sabbath inadvertently, he should bring a standard, unvarying chatat. So he's not going to repeat this principle. That's why I want to make sure to say it in this one. That when you say intentional sin, you mean witnesses and warning. So we discussed that once before, right? Witnesses and warning. Mm-hmm. Two people see you and say, Miriam Fortune, do you know that if you write, do you know today is the Sabbath? And do you know if you pick up that pencil and write today, that you will be violating the Sabbath? And you have to say, yes, I know today is a Sabbath, and I know that writing is in violation, and I choose to do it anyway. And then you write in front of those two witnesses, then they go to the Beit Din and say, we witnessed it. That's what makes it an intentional sin. When do we have that? Never, right? So, I mean, that's just ridiculous that all that would happen. Hopefully never, right? So there can be no death penalty or even whipping, except when there are witnesses and warning. So that's the definition of intentional sin. So even if we see somebody intentionally doing something, it's not counted as intentional all the way that they deserve the death penalty. Certainly not by Beit Din. Now, some people do say that there are other ways to mete out that death penalty because that does serve as an atonement. So possibly car accidents and things like that are like stoning, or, you know, so there are things like when people die in different ways that is God's way of exacting that death penalty upon that person so that they should have the atonement that they need to be able to progress spiritually according to the good that they did and leave behind the bad that they did in this world. So, but it's not ever human meted out unless there's witnesses and warning. Okay, that's it for today. And next time we'll look at the
36 and 37.
Yeah, 36 and 37. That's Radish.